Cool. Hey, thanks for joining us. New type of intro. Today, our guest is a guy named Stefan Lintner. Stefan is a friend of mine. He is the founder and CEO of an interesting fintech startup called Jiko. I've known him for a couple of years, and they keep moving forward and doing more and more interesting things. And they finally hit the point where I thought it would be interesting to you guys as well. So welcome, Stefan.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, it's great. And so so many different things to ask you about. But, you know, let me start with an easy one. And this is based on both all the work you did at Goldman and then kind of why you created Jiko, which is, why is the global banking system so messed up?
Well, I mean, that's a view to call it messed up. But assuming that that we can say at least that it needs evolution, it's old. I mean, it's been built way before you had any kind of technology. Think about the amazing capabilities of Wall Street back in the 20s or even before. It was built on leverage, paper checks, paper clearing, lots of trust amongst institutions. So it's built on this pyramid where you trust something bigger above you that trusts something bigger above you. And then in the end, all this has to clear. So it's worked really well. It was the engine of growth, but it's antiquated. And in an age of technology, you don't need to rely on these mechanisms. So I think it goes back to leverage.
So you were on Wall Street directly during the financial crisis in 08. How much of that do you think might have not happened if there were better technology, you know, 12 years ago?
It's not just technology. I think that's something we keep saying. It's really the model of where does the capital come from that the banks are using, or not the capital, but the source of funds? It's the deposits. It's this thing where you have the fractional banking. You only have that much money in the bank. Everything's lent out. FDIC is backing it. So the incentives are not really lined up. And at some point, you know, the cycles grow, and every 7 years you have the same cycles. Technology exacerbates that, actually. What you really want to use is technology to undo some of that and create a stable money storage layer that everybody can use. That's what blockchain has attempted to do. And so you got to delever a little bit, decouple the bare necessity of, I've got a paycheck, I need my money stored, or I'm a big business, and I want to store some money, I'm going to move it around. Why does that have to be entangled with the banks lending on the back, doing all sorts of stuff? So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. And so how did kind of you seeing that lead to the idea for Jiko? And I guess, if you don't mind, give the listeners some background on kind of what Jiko is and what you're trying to accomplish.
Sure. Well, what we're trying to do is precisely that. Give everyone a clean layer to store your money and then move it around. That's kind of what normally you need a bank account for. We're trying to change this notion that if I have money at the bank, I don't know where it is and the bank is using it. Again, historically, it's been great and we need credit in society. But for the core layer, I want my cash to be safe and accessible. And so we're building to build that, we've gone the route of doing it right. So you don't do that without being regulated. So we've had to acquire a bank. We've had to set up a broker dealer, make sure that you are now the one who's invested in very safe instruments like government securities, treasury bills. People aren't very familiar with them, but that's really what we use. And suddenly, as a Jiko user now, you're a proud owner of American treasuries. Remember the savings bond from your grandmother? It's the same kind of instrument. You own that, but you can spend at any time. It's very fluid and it doesn't rely on anything too complicated. It fits the current system and it brings a level of stability to people who are on the platform that you haven't had before.
So I'm like a Citibank or Bank of America customer. Why would I want to switch to a fully digital operation like Jiko?
Fully digital, you probably already are because most branches are closed these days, but
good point. Yeah.
So digital is kind of, you know, the necessity now, but the really digital money, if you will, where your money is now absolutely accessible in the form of an investment. Well, it's the ultimate. That's what every penny you own should be invested for you rather than for someone else. So marginally over time, you'll have benefits from that. Yield and other things, transparency. You know that the institution is safe and it's not going to go down because the money is there. So now we can service one person, but we can also service 300 million and or all the businesses. Businesses don't get access to the FDIC. So what they do is exactly that. So for you, it's going to be that. And because we're built clean, it's a little bit like the electric car, we can innovate. because we have our own technology. We're not bound by the balance sheet issues and all the complexity. Therefore, we can focus on what matters to you, which is easy access to the money, the ability to move it around, the ability to create sub-accounts, to link it to all the things that actually matter in your life. Because the only focus we have is the experience, as opposed to figuring out what to do with your money.
And so right now, I mean, my assumption is if I have, you know, $5,000 sitting in my account at Citibank, I can go in there and do whatever I want with it. Is that not true?
I'll give you an example where it's not exactly true. Let's say you have $5,000 in your account, and maybe if you're lucky, not everyone has that, but has also additional money in their savings. And now, you know, it happens once in a while, and payments come through, or some check that you forgot you wrote, or an insurance that's due suddenly in the middle of nowhere, and boom, now payments hit your account. You don't have enough, except you had enough in your savings. Well, that's not automatically debited. You just got charged an overdraft. Why is it that it's not fluid from a savings to a checking? Because the savings money is deployed in a different way. The banks have to manage their liability versus the term of how versus the money that they owe you. So a savings has blocks. These blocks are there on purpose so the money can be lent out longer term. That doesn't apply in our cases. So it's absolute fluidity. We have some features that we're building that create as many sub-accounts as you want, allowing you to really manage and pre-allocate your money. No matter what it's in a sub-account or the main account, it's always growing at the risk-free rate. We just eliminate some of these barriers. So they're subtle, but there's all these little pain points that over time, are not, make the banking experience not that great. And we're just getting rid of those.
And so fair to say that if you put your money in G-Code, your money is kind of segregated and there for you whenever you need it. And at least in theory, you know, that doesn't necessarily exist in kind of the giant banks.
Yeah. I mean, with the banks, you trust the FDIC, not really the bank's capability to have all the money available. You trust the FDIC to step in if there's an issue, which, you know, if you look historically, it's not a very pleasant experience. It's still, you know, for you look at the Washington Mutual clients back then, it was not the most pleasant experience. And in the end, why do you rely on the FDIC? But who's backing the FDIC? It's the credit line that they have from the United States Treasury. So all we're saying is maybe if you go directly and face the Treasury yourself, you have, you should in theory just have better yield and better, a cheaper experience overall.
Right. So if the GECO deposits are getting put in Treasuries and Treasury is what backs the FDIC, in theory, the risk profile is roughly the same, but your view is that you can just get better returns for your money with GECO than you are with, you know, Wells Fargo or whatever.
And peace of mind, because now you're in an institution that is not focused that has very little, you know, systemic risk. It can really work for everyone in bad times or good times. And we saw it when back in March, the market crashed, the Treasury bills rallied, right? So that it was great to be a GECO user at that moment. So you're facing a very stable institution that is also very scalable. And when things are good, you get yield. When things are bad, it holds. And that's kind of what you want for your primary layer. The first place for your money should be something like that.
And so how do you, it's a compelling argument. So I wanted to have you, you know, on the podcast, but how do you get people to actually go to the trouble of closing out a bank account and opening one with you guys?
That's assuming that that we're going to ask people to close their accounts. I mean,
you know, yeah, good point. Maybe you don't care.
There's demand for the product. And then really the way to think about it in its current form, we're launching Velvet Rope Invitation Only. That we have a wait list and we're going to grow it. And there's, it's like, you know, like the electric car at the beginning. It had its own issue. You can only drive 100 miles with it. Why would you buy a car that can only go 100 miles? So we're in this early cycle of a disrupting or innovative approach. But the innovation capabilities that we have and the scale makes us a very reliable platform at very, very low cost. So down the road, we'll open up the platform to others to sit on. And that's when the whole ecosystem starts to really take its value. And over time, you may have a secondary account with us because it's just more useful and more plugged in into many other places than your standard checking account. So
you guys have this kind of API, this platform that all these different things can plug into. So give me the vision in 3 years, 5 years, I'm a customer, and now when I log into my GECO account, I can do what?
Well, maybe you've been onboarded through one of your favorite companies because maybe they're running on GECO, powered by GECO. We're still the bank and the broker dealer behind it. So, you know, in the modern world of fintechs and big tech wanting to enter the financial world, you still need an institution behind. That's the whole point of regulated. We're investing heavily in making ourselves one of the most modern and capable technology company that can do that, technology and regulated company. So in that world, you may have been onboarded in a, pick your favorite company. I'm not going to name any because we're not necessarily talking to all of them, but to potentially some of them. So, but let's say Apple or Google or Facebook Cash, you name it, one of those powered by Jiko. Well, what it means is, or Starbucks Cash powered by Jiko, you'd get your experience there. But you can always download the free Jiko app at that moment, the dashboard, and it will show you all your connections, because ultimately the Jiko holding, we're still in the bank, the money is held in T-bills, and we should be able to at least transparently show you who's connected, who's touching your money. And for you, you get the trust, because if you see our logo on a Starbucks Cash or another app, you know, it's like Intel, you know that this is a brand I trust. I know that the money's safe. I've heard about it. Can always go check. So we're giving you that dashboard, that stability place, that maybe it's not something you have to go to all day long, because your experience is embedded in other places, but you've got that core institution that you trust in a way that you would not trust an unregulated company.
So how do you guys make money?
Platform fee. So it's a membership fee. So the initial product that we'll roll out, which is going to be more and more, is going to roll out with a number of key features. We'll have a membership fee on this. Down the road, if we leave access to others, then others to expose our product through the APIs, and we'll charge them. What we don't plan on doing, obviously, we can't make money off your money because we don't touch it. It's yours. It's invested for you. And then the traditional things like getting the interchange when you swipe your card, that's a business we understand where it comes from, but it's great. We'd like to pass that back to you. It's your money. It's your card. You're spending. Let's give that back to you. So the interchange will go back to the users. If you use your card, and we'll just live off the membership fee, which forces us to operate like Netflix or Amazon Prime. It's all about giving you the better experience instead of optimizing things behind your back or selling your data.
So what's your sense of how the traditional banking industry is viewing you guys? And do they see you as a threat, or are they kind of just too big to even notice what you're up to right now?
I'd rather say we're too small right now for anybody to worry. And we're not rogue. We're part of the inner circle of regulated institutions, highly scrutinized by the regulators. So we're playing within the square field. If anything, I think we can help the industry by, think about all the small community banks, everyone else, they all have too much cash, don't necessarily know what to do with it, and they have to manage ins and outs, deposits, and all the technology. We've rebuilt things clean, so our APIs could also be made available to the industry. The money storage in the form of customers holding T-bills, we can streamline that, make it available. We're not competing in lending. We're not out there to touch credit. That's what the lenders are really good at. And I think, if anything, we can eliminate pain points and make it smoother for everyone.
And you guys actually went out ahead and bought a bank. How'd you do that, and why'd you do it?
How we did it was with lots of patience. The reason we did it is because the platform I described, it requires two things. It requires us to really be able to process payments, right? For as much as your money is invested in a brokerage account in treasury bills very safely, payments in the United States and in most countries is usually managed by banking regulators. And we didn't want to be in what most other companies do, which is to start partnering with a bank. And once you start going that route, you don't control your destiny. You don't know at what point the bank management might change. The board may change directions, may require more capital. The fee structure may change. The CTOs inside the bank may not be lined up in terms of features and risk appetite and things like that. Very complicated. We wanted to own our destiny. So we decided to go ahead and be the bank ourselves. And it took us 3 to 4 years, as you know, Bradley. We had conversations very early on.
Yeah.
But then it was just an arduous process of very friendly with the regulators. Both agencies, the Fed and the OCC, have been collaborating hand in hand, and it's been quite amazing. But it just takes time because there's no stone unturned.
Do you know of other fintech companies that have actually bought physical banks like that?
I'm not aware of any, no.
Yeah. It's pretty different. But obviously, if you have the access capital and patience like you guys did, the benefits are pretty significant, which is, almost an interesting lesson generally for digital companies, that there may be physical nexuses and links that are at times worth pursuing. And you've got, you can't always assume that solely digital is always going to be better in every way. So how has COVID impacted you guys?
Not much. We but interestingly enough, we set up the company to be relatively virtual upfront. Our engineers are in Iceland. I moved to California and we started staffing here, but we still have a few people on the East Coast. So we learned early on to work across different time zones on Zoom. We all have families, so we've learned how to operate like that. It hasn't been so in terms of internally, it hasn't been a big problem. Right. Externally, right now we're heads down trying to close the bank, which we just did. So we haven't really launched. I think the environment is even, and people are going to look for safety, and a safe place to store your money and operate digitally is even should resonate even more now. So
yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking, which is like, I don't know if there's studies around this yet or not, but how do people feel about using ATMs? And do you think that if people kind of get used to not using them, does that start to change norms and behavior for consumers?
I think so. The more people get used to digital, the more they'll also start trusting larger payments over. I mean, you look at Venmo and other companies already, Cash App, massive market share. The larger amounts like wires and big ACHs, that's still, you know, square territory of the banks. But if people get more comfortable with digital, the controls get better. It's all about controlling the flows. You can imagine a lot of those experiences getting also more and more digital embedded in the day-to-day experience of your app. So the need to show out a branch, go to the ATM, that should all drop over time, for sure.
How are you thinking about the election and kind of what's more important to you? Specific policies on one side or the other, or kind of stability and less volatility in our government?
Policy-wise, you know, I mean, people have talked about deregulation for a while. We at GECO haven't had to need for deregulation. We fit, you know, financial markets are pretty old, so regulators know what to look for. The rules of the games are pretty well established. So we played within that and made it through. So, I mean, maybe you can make certain things a little easier, but as far as we're concerned, the framework works and we're operating within. Not to say that you shouldn't push more for innovation and sandboxes and things like this. Stability in general would be good for everyone in terms of knowing how to plan your business ahead and what to do.
I mean, so, you know, you're not from the U.S. and I imagine that to a certain extent you had positive views of it because it made you choose to move mm-hmm. here and stay here. Could you ever have predicted the level of kind of uncertainty that we have right now? Or when you were living in Europe and growing up there, did that seem inconceivable?
It's a good question. I came here when I was 20. The first time I came, I was not even 21. So I discovered that I couldn't have a beer, although I could, you know, could do everything else. That was my first internship at Caltech. After that, so until then, you know, you looked at America through the lens, especially in the 90s, of the internet and the the free country where amazing opportunities. Then having lived here since, because I moved here permanently in 2002 to be a graduate student, the country's evolved, so has the rest of the world. So what I tend to tell people sometimes, look at the rest. The U.S. still has so much potential and so much hope and so many safeguards between the states and federal and the momentum behind it, and now it's going into space. I'm still very hopeful.
So for Americans who are despondent about the state of politics today, and I think that includes a lot of people on both sides of the political spectrum, how should they view Europe? And sometimes I think Europe gets held up here as this kind of idyllic, stable form of government and life. Is that right? Or how should people intelligently think about how the U.S. compares to Western Europe?
Okay, I wasn't expecting that kind of questions, but
By the way, we got about to. I'm just curious.
Well, there's one major difference. The U.S. is still a relatively united country. I mean, it has its polarization, but it's just between two forces that have always existed in the world from, you know, what people call left and right, with all the spectrum in between. Europe is lots of countries that don't even speak the same language. The unity there isn't at the same level at all. There's no equivalent of a U.S. army down there. If anything, if the U.S. starts to be focused more on itself, Europe may be in for some stability reckoning, because the shroud under which Europe has lived under American protection since World War II is isn't necessarily going to be there. So I'm not sure that the way Europe is perceived here as this very peaceful and advanced center. I love that because I grew up there and I've always enjoyed the safety net and what it comes with it. But the question of how sustainable is it, it's going to be a question for Europeans to start uniting instead of going back to national roots in each within each border. That's my view. But what is?
I'm actually makes total sense. So Stefan, how do people listen to this podcast sign up for GECO? How do they learn more about it?
So right now you can get on the wait list. We took everything down around the time where we got approved because it moved really fast on us. We were not sure what to expect. So we're about to bring back the web a more exciting website than what we have right now, but you can already sign up on the wait list. We're going to start issuing invitations. You can always email us. There's only going to be that many spots this year. We want to be careful. If you join now, you'll be early on the bandwagon and exposed to the next generation features very, very quickly. So now is a good time. It's a wait list.
Cool. Great. Well, as someone who is a friend of the company and has known these guys for a while, I highly encourage you to check it out. So Stefan Littner, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Brad.